Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's Wednesday. I've already started teaching in the university and elsewhere, and therefore it's hard for me to get these podcasts done before time, but Wednesday we're still in time. This week I see, although I got a lot of emails from people that do Ralph Cook, but that's too wide a topic. That's a very complicated topic. But on the other hand, I see it's the Tosfos Yontov, and that's something I can sink my teeth into or try to, even though, to be perfectly honest, that's also a gigantic topic. But you don't know that, so it's easier for me to do it shorter. The Tosfos Yontov is the name of a rabbi, the name of a book he wrote called Tosfos Yontov, which literally is for the math and science people out there, is Tosefes Yontov, but we all call it Tosfos Yontov. That's Rabbi Yontov Lippman Heller. And we're talking with somebody from the 17th century, from the 1600s. 1579, I think, to 1654. You know, so mainly 1600s. Now, what separates him out of someone else, I mean, other than the fact that it's a Yahrzeit? Very, very interesting person. And one of the most celebrated of the early modern rabbis, because his Baal HaBatim tried to murder him. So that's pretty good. I mean, he must have been pretty good. Now, it's a very interesting story. The person I'm talking about, Yontov Lippman Heller, that's the name, Yontov Lippman is the first name. He is born in Germany in 1579. I know that doesn't mean anything to most of you, but that's very interesting because there were almost no Jews in Germany in the 1500s. Once upon a time, the country that you and I call Germany didn't exist as such, but instead was called the Holy Roman Empire, and composed of dozens and dozens of small German states that were sort of connected together and sort of not. Most of the time they fought each other. And over the course of the late Middle Ages, the 12th, 13th, 1400s, the Jews were kicked the heck out of Germany in almost, I would say, 96, 97% of the country, which means that in the 1200s and then in the next couple centuries, first this town and then that one and then this Medina and then that one, all expelled the Jews or murdered them. There are many places in which it was just a pogrom broke out and they killed everybody. I've mentioned before, you know, like the Mordechai in Bagger Gemara was one of these victims. Him and his whole community was killed out in one of these crazy German pogroms in the 1200s. And you really see the Germans like loathed and hated the presence of the Jews and wanted them out of there, which is something that came to roost in Hitler's time. And so if I tell you that I'm talking about somebody who was born in one of the German states in the 1500s, that's actually rather unusual. Most of the Jews had moved east to Poland, to places like that. So he's born in Bavaria, real Yekki, super Yekkish. Most of the Yekkis that you and I know today, most, are not from families that stayed all the way in Germany century after century. Most of them are Jews who were kicked out of Germany in the 12, 13, 14, 1500s. And then 100 or 200 years later, returned back. But there are some that stayed all the way through. These are the super Yekkes. And this guy, Yontov Lippman Heller, came from such a background, a small village, Wallerstein, small village in Bavaria, as is true of many Baltimore Jews. And the father was a rav or something like that. So he grew up, and, you know, as you hear about in the stories, he was an Eloi from a young age. Now, it's the late 1500s. There was one substantial Jewish community in the German Empire, in the Holy Roman Empire at that time. And just that one, and it was an important one. And that is Prague, which I bet you had several thousand Jews in the 1500s. And that's why if you're a German Jewish boy and you want to learn in Yeshiva in Germany, defining Germany as the whole Central Europe area of the Holy Roman Empire, you go to Prague, which had multiple yeshivas, and was really cooking. And so this young boy, Yontov Lippman Heller, goes as a teenager to Prague And the rabbi at that time, we're talking about the 1590s, is the Maral. When I was on my trip last month in Prague, in July actually, I gave a great deal of talking about the Maral and the Yehuda and people like that. I skipped over to the Tosfos Yontif. The Maral was a nonconformist, a iconoclast, kind of a rebel against the system. He's always criticizing the yeshiva system, and he tried out many times to be the rabbi in Prague, and of course lost because he couldn't refrain from keeping his mouth shut and telling the Balabatim what he really thought of them, and telling the Rosh Yeshivas and the rabbis what he thought of them. We consider them all losers. Now this is rather remarkable. That's the story of the Maral. And he had his own, she did her own system of learning, and I don't want to get too bogged down in that, other than to say that this young Yontif Lippmann Heller goes, and as a teenager, he learns with an unusual guttle, as we would say today, in the yeshiva in Prague, under the Maral, and became a disciple. He must have been really something hot, because at 18, he became a dayan on the Maral's basin. That's pretty good for Ben Shmunasar, right? Now, Prague, in the period I'm talking about, in the 1580s, 1590s, very early 1600s, was actually going through one of its good periods as far as the Jews are concerned. It came and went. Sometimes things are better, sometimes things are worse. I can't explain now why, during the reign of Rudolf II, things were relatively better, but that's what happened. So when he was there in Prague, it's a beautiful city. I was there, like I say, a little over a month ago. It's very pretty, and good weather and so forth, and there was a good economy. And in the time I'm speaking about, when the Maral was there in his yeshiva, it was the capital of Germany, believe it or not, the capital of the Holy Roman Empire, because the Kaiser, the Emperor, Rudolf II, chose to reside there, not in Vienna. And it was the headquarters of science, and this and that and the other. So these were happy times, and this young guy, if he's born in 1579, so we're dealing 1597, 1598, the Maral was an old man, but he's still the Rav there, and these are young Dayanimis recruiting to help him on there. The Maral is against the yeshivaship, regular learning, people without any system. He was Mr. System, and he's the guy you always hear about, where he said, you should first learn Chumash, and then you learn Mishnayos, and after you master all the Mishnayos, then you start the Gemara, you know, in a very organized, orderly fashion, which is something you hear about all the time, but every time they ever tried to put in practice, it kind of never worked, which is an interesting aspect of Jewish educational history. But now I don't have time to go into that, other than to touch on it as a Nogea to our subject. So this young guy, Yontif Lippmann Heller, has it pretty good, and he married there, and he basically stayed in Prague for the first 50 years of his life, I would say, something like that. So, more or less, certainly the first 40. And that means that he's a Yeki of a certain variety, such as doesn't exist later on. And Prague is the place, and he's one of the hot scholars that turns it into the place. When the Maral died, he was already a little out of it. He was succeeded by by one of his students, the Kliyakar, and the Kliyakar then by Yontif Lippmann Heller, eventually the Tosfos Yontif. So here's somebody who becomes the Rav in Prague. And like I said, when I was in Prague with my group last month, in July rather, so you have a limited amount of time. You're there for 2 days or something like that. And, you know, you can only talk so much, even me. And so I devoted most of my remarks when we were going through the Prague ghetto to the two most famous rabbis that associated public mind with Prague. One is the Maral and the other is Novi Yehuda. But there were many others. And one of the others is the Tosfos Yontif, Yontif Lippmann Heller. While he was in Prague, so especially being a member of the Beis Din, so here's a guy who starts in Beis Din 18 and in his 20s and in his 30s. So, you know, he's hot stuff. And he learns up a storm. And money he had, he was not poor. I think he might maybe married into money or something like that. And he owned a nice home. And he had the kind of big house that one room could be his private little yeshiva or something like that, which was not uncommon in Prague. And so he had Torah Gadol v'Malkum Echad. And he was very widely read and learned. By that I mean not only Shas and Poskim, but being a student of the Maral, more widely read, you know, in the philosophy books like the Mor Nebuchadnezzar and the Kuzri and all that sort of thing, and others that you never heard about before, Yedaya Bederisi and small, unusual authors. I would even call him, even though this is totally the wrong word, I would even call him a Maskil in the sense that he was into Ivrit and into Tanakh and into, poetry and those kind of things, which aren't just Gemara, although certainly somebody like him, you can be darn sure, put in 99% of the time into Gemara, and halacha. Because if he's on the basin of Prague, they are Paskin and Shalas right and left. They're writing Shalas and Shubas all the time. So far, so good. As part of the legacy of the Maral, he obviously got involved very much in the study of Mishnayos because one of the many, many sides of the Maral, many-sided figure, is the fact that he discerned, the Maral I'm talking about, the unhealthy nature, the unhealthy intellectual sociology of the Jewish community of yesteryear, which in plain English means it's not good if two or three guys in town know how to learn and nobody else knows anything. That's unhealthy. Frum communities can't exist on that basis. If the learned class is really extremely narrow and everybody else knows pretty much bupkis, then they're not going to be able to follow the dinim and they'll have contempt or they'll certainly be wondering what the rabbis are doing. They'll be divorced from the mainstream of Torah life, as we should say. And instead, rather, I'm talking about the Maral now, a healthy Jewish community will be composed of, in a chanami, an elite of real big learners, there are never many of those, but a large middle class, shall we say, intellectual middle class, of people who know a nice, decent amount, what we would call today a learned balabas. He ain't a rabbi exactly, he can't paskin a shaila, but knows how to learn, as we would say. And it's really fascinating to me that the Maral, therefore, advocated measures to help widen the Jewish knowledge, Torah knowledge, of a much broader class of people than had formerly been the case. So if a yeshiva, as was the case in the time of the Maral, was for a few real smarties, and from a very early age on, you started learning Tosas and asking kashas and making chalukim, as they called in those days, and pilpul and all this stuff, you're automatically icing out like 90% of the guys in the yeshiva, let alone people who are not going to yeshiva. So you're just going to grow up with a whole bunch of people in town who went for a little while to yeshiva, had a very negative experience. They know a little bit, but they're like turned off from the whole learning and all the rest of it. They're cynical at the Rabbanim because those are the few winners that had it good and had the good shidduch and this and that and the other. And it's just unhealthy. You understand? It's unhealthy. And so what this boils down to in plain language is that the Maral advocated a much larger learning of Mishnayos. Because the learning of Mishnah is indeed a fantastic way for a regular person to acquire very wide bekiyas and knowledge of the Torah Shabbat Peh. Now, from a super yeshivish point, they'll say, even in that time they had super yeshivish point. Mishnah is for losers, that sort of thing. Real men learn Tosas, he hated that kind of mahalach. But he said, what's the point of one guy spending all his time learning Baba Kama, for example, for years and years, and giving you a little booklet with his Chidushim, and he doesn't know much of anything else, and a lot of his thoughts are based on the fact that he's just wrong because he didn't know this Mishnah here and that Gemara there. What we call today lack of Bekiyas. Now, not everybody's cut out to be a Bucky Bekiyas in terms of finishing Shas or finishing Homosechtas. Nowadays, with the Art Scroll and all that, I'm serious now, with the Daf Yomi, new vistas has opened up. But I'm talking about yesteryear. It wasn't for everybody. It's for very, very few. Ain't too many Shakasaryas out there, And so, how does somebody get a Sipag on Nefesh and learning, and how are they ever going to be able to finish any? Well, the answer is Mishnayos. Somebody makes a Seder, if a synagogue or a community sets up a Chevra Mishnah, which they didn't used to have, then it's totally possible, if people are diligent, that they can go through Shisha Seder Mishnah, certainly they can go through Moed, Nash, and Mezikin, and know a heck of a lot, even if you don't know all the Gemaras, even if you're not super duper, all the Tosas and the other Rishonim, all the rest of it. You come out knowing a Gansa Fina amount, a pretty impressive amount of knowledge. I'll just give you one example off the top of my head. And this is how the Maral would approach it. And then his students. I'm speaking now at the beginning of the month of Elul. Pretty soon, in a couple weeks, is coming Tishrei. Well, from the Maralian point of view, here's what you should do. Go through the Mishnayos, Rosh Hashanah, Yuma, Sukkah, and you'll go through, you'll, all of a sudden you'll hit Yanta with a lot of Yediyas. And also a Beitzah and Moed Katan, because Beitzah is the laws of Yantav. After all, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot are Yantavs. Plus, Moed Katan is about the Chol HaMoed. So you do those five Mesechtas in the Mishnayos, and especially if you do them well, you're going to know quite a bit about the upcoming holidays. Now, it's not the same thing going through the Gemara, but still, you will know quite a bit. So, if you just diss and say, well, that's for people who don't know any better, then to him, to the Maral and his students, you're doing a terrible disservice. Consequently, they looked at the project of Mishnayos as like a major tool to raising the broad level of the average Joe out there, the average intelligent Joe out there, and therefore creating a much more intellectually healthy Jewish community. I hope I made myself clear. This is just very interesting. Now, you have to understand, for many centuries, there wasn't any commentary on the Mishnah. It's not a good one. Rashi didn't write on the Mishnah. The other Rishonim didn't write on the Mishnah. The Rambam did. But first of all, the Rambam wrote in Arabic and in Judeo-Arabic. And it wasn't out for a lot of people because it's the translations of the Rambam's commentary on the Mishnah were always junky. Everybody knows this. There weren't good translations from the Arabic until, I'd say, the 20th century was Kapach. There were a couple of other Rishonim, like the Rashba, not the Rashba, but the Rashba, Shimshon ben Avraham Masantz, the Baal Tosas, who wrote on some of these, Kutchim and Tyrus type Masechtas. But that's for the Talmud Chacham. That is not for the average guy. That's a pretty deep kind of commentary. I mean, I could also call your attention to Rav Haigon, who wrote, a learned thing on Tyrus. But generally speaking, the average guy out there, if you want to learn Mishnayos, there's nothing to help him. And therefore, it's a closed book. Only when the Bar Tanura came along in the late 1400s, Rav Avadya of Bar Tanura, he realized what I just said. He lived in Italy, and I think discerned the same thing that I was talking about before, the unhealthy sociology and the desire to spread the knowledge of the Mishnah among broad masses so that you could come to a community. And the Chevra Shas is not for everybody, but the Chevra Shas should be for most people. And the rabbi, whoever, should give a shiur every day or whatever in the Mishnayos. And you could cover quite a bit. And the Bar Tanura therefore composed his famous Rav, the Bar Tanura, which became like the Rashi on the Mishnayos. What the Bar Tanura, of course, did was he mishtach together, he combined Rashi and the... Because Rashi is in the Gemara, and the Gemara does have the Mishnayos. So you will have, Rashi on that part of the Mishnah, that you find in the Shas, even though it's not technically a commentary in the Mishnah per se, and also the Rambam. The Rambam style, by the way, is not the friendliest. It has a plus and a minus. And I'm saying all this for a reason. The Rambam style, if you ever do the Rambam's commentary in the Mishnah, is to be very broad. He'll give you big klolim that are very, very important to know, but he doesn't do it word by word, line by line. It's not his style, okay? It's a more, what's the right word? Broad and discursive. But the Bar Tanura made it much, much more. That was in the early 1500s. Now we're talking about the late 1500s, early 1600s. So Yontav Lippman Heller, who's Yartzei this week, he took this Maral idea, and he obviously, it's clear to me as day, he had his own little private yeshiva going on over there because he had things good in Prague. And he obviously said, look here, in this yeshiva mine or in this morning seder or whatever, we're making a systematic, we, the yeshiva guys, the learned ones, the guys who know how to learn, right? We know Shas and Poskim. I mean, these are the older guys, as it were. He probably had 5, 10 guys, 15 guys, for all I know, learning in his house in his private base medrash. And he said, we're going to make a thorough, learned study of the Mishnayos. So when we learn the Mishnayos, we're also going to learn the Gemara with it. You follow what I'm saying? They were bar halki to do that. And after we finish that project, so let's say just off the top of my head, you're learning, Mishnayos, I don't know, Rosh Hashanah is coming up. Rosh Hashanah, right? So, there are four Rosh Hashanahs, and like the Masechta starts. There are Abba Rosh Hashanahs. So they learned the Gemara with it, and if you're a Yontav Lipman Heller, you learned the Yerushalmi with it and all that stuff, and the Rishonim and all this kind of business, the Tosas. And then after that, then you say like this, how can we summarize all our research and write it on the side of the, as a commentary sort of on the Mishnah. But it's more than just a line-by-line commentary. It's much bigger, much broader than that. It takes into account all the research we did in the other Gemaras and in the Rishonim and this and that and the other and the Halacha L'maisa. And being that he was a very broad-minded guy, I told you that Shtickle Moskal, because a broad-minded guy, he's also interested in the dicta questions and if ever you have realia, like what's the science, according to science of that day, what's the science have to say about this subject? He did have a copy of Euclid, because there's certain Mishnahs like Kalim, you got to know the geometry. You see what I'm saying? You bring in all the science and the history and all the rest of it. By the way, he tried in his level to bring in historical stuff like from Josephus, believe it or not, and places like that, Azari de Rossi. And then you compose your commentary. This commentary he called Tosefis Yontava. Like I said, for the math and scientists out there, there's a concept in the Gemara called adding to Yontav and to Shabbos, correct? I don't know if you notice, it's a din, that you don't start Shabbos at the very, very beginning of Shabbos, but you have to start a minute or two before. It's called Tosefes Shabbos, same thing with Yontav. You're not supposed to start Yontav and light the candles literally at the moment Yontav begins, but a little before, minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever. You know where you can read about this if you're at all interested in the subject? Yom Kippur is coming up, so Zevin and the Modim Malacha, I remember it by heart, has a nice little piece about Tosas Yontav and Negeit Yom Kippur, you know, where you have to start fasting beforehand. But what is the word? Adding on to Yontav, adding on to Shabbos. How do you say that in Hebrew? Tosefes Shabbos, Tosefes Yontav. See, his name was Yontav Lipman Heller, so he called his commentary that he's composing with the Yeshiva guys together Tosefes Yontav. But you know how the world is. They can't remember. They say Tosas Yontav. So I say also, I mean, we all say Tosas Yontav. And he did this for Shisha Sidri Mishnah, baby. The whole business. Kachim, Tyrus, Zeroim, and all the rest of it. Mishnah by Mishnah, learning it through with his guys. Almost like doing like Rashi did with the Gemara. And bringing a potpourri of attitudes. You know, the Halach L'maisa sometimes, and the science sometimes, and the Lumda sometimes, and the Rishonim and the Achronim according to his time sometimes. And his idea was to give the learner out there, the guy who's learning, to copy what he just did. Let the Mishnahs not just be for losers. Let the Mishnahs not just be for guys that are, from the Hamon Am, that are just doing a Chevr Mishnahs. That's good too. He's 100% in favor of that. That's fine. That's great. But let's move it up a notch. And the learners themselves should learn the Mishnahs and learn it with a Be'in and thoroughly and look up the different places the way he did. And this he called Tosas Yontav. So the Tosas Yontav is a commentary on the whole Mishnahs, and since the title sounds like Tosefes, it sounds like Tosas Yontav, so long ago they started to publish the Mishnahs with the Bar Tanur on one side and the Tosas Yontav on the other side, so it looks like a page of Gemara. The Bar Tanur is like Rashi, and Tosas Yontav is like Tosas. It's not exactly like Tosas, but a little bit it is. And what it does is it has the function of deepening the person's understanding of the Mishnah, but you have to spend time and work through it. It's not easy necessarily, okay? It's not so easy. This took off like wildfire once upon a time. Not today. Now, I just live in Baltimore, so I don't know what's going on in the whole world, but my impression is, since we live in a day of art scroll, and the Daf Yomi, and the Steinsaltz, and this, and then, and the Masifta, and so forth, I think the Tosas Yontav today has been sort of like a Cinderella. It's like pushed aside, I think. Most people I know that are learning Mishnahs are doing with Kahati or the Art Scroll or something like that. Isn't that right? You know, isn't that usually how it goes? And I get there's nothing wrong with that. Nothing at all. It's fine. But I'm just saying that's short, sweet, and to the point. It's written deliberately, K-A-S-S. And somebody told me the other day, I think Avi Noam, that the Art Scroll now put out an even more dummy-friendly set of the Mishnahs, which, again, is a great thing. I'm all in favor of it. It's really a great idea. So what I mean is the existing Art Scroll Mishnah, not the Art Scroll Gemara Mishnah, is quite a dense work of scholarship. You know, I've done some. Steve Camp and I are doing the Mikvos now with the Art Scroll. I mean, it's quite a work of scholarship, but it's not. And it's in English. Anybody can do it, but it requires fair amount of depth. This new art scroll Mishnah, I believe, is more down to earth, I think. I haven't seen it, but this is what I heard. Anyhow, the point is it's the world of Mishnayos. And he became perhaps the most important commentary, or maybe the second most important commentary. So before there existed art scroll, and before there existed, the art scroll Mishnah and Kahati. So what you had to learn Mishnayos with the Bar Tanura and the Tosfos Yontif. And in Germany, the Veritas Roll. This became the class. This is, so for the 1600s, the 1700s, the 1800s, I would say, early into early 1900s, you found all over Europe, and European Jews in America and elsewhere, the synagogues and communities would have Chevron Mishnayos. Not a shir like you have now, Daf Yomi, which is we call a Chevron Shas, but it's a Chevron Mishnayos. And there'd be some, you know, rabbi or something, and he would learn with a bunch of people, usually Balabatim, you know, businessmen, craftsmen, people like that. And they could go through Gantz Mishnayos like that. And they would learn it with the Bar Tanur. And if there was a little bit of a more lumdish group over there, they'd do it with the Tosfos Yontif. And everybody was happy. It's quite an accomplishment. But I'll say it again, it's not easy. I recall this, and I mentioned before, if you look in the Note of Yehuda, there's a very famous, notorious case about this yeshiva boy who lived with a family, got involved in an affair with the married lady of the house, and then ended up marrying the daughter. Oh my goodness, it's a triple X-rated tshuva. And the sinner, the guy involved who was the sinner, then wrote to the rabbi, wrote to Novi Yehuda, probably that's a disguise, probably wrote to Novi Yehuda, and he said like this, aside from all the other questions over here, now I realize what I've done wrong. And he did, according to the story, he confessed. You know, nobody discovered the affair, he just confessed. He said, I want you to prescribe for me a penance. What shall I do to torture myself, afflict myself? Which is an old Ashkenazic thing. You know, now's the month of Elul. We're all going to learn Rambam, Hilchos Teshuvah, and things like that. Those are about repentance. The Talmud knows about repentance. But in Jewish history, in the Middle Ages, there developed a whole culture of penance in which you have to flagellate yourself or burn yourself or, I don't know, this, that, and the other, hurt yourself physically. And the sinners solicit this. They say, I've done a terrible sin. I want to feel the pain so I can get rid of it on this side. So when I die, I'll go clean into the next side. And the guy writes to the Note of Yehuda and he says, I was involved in this heavy affair, I think 5 years, if I remember correctly. And that's a long time. That's a lot of myself errors over there. And the Note of Yehuda says something along the lines, I'm not into penance. You know, I don't know about this Hasidic stuff, as he calls it. But, and he didn't mean the modern Hasidic, he mean the old Hasidic. But if you want to torture yourself all the rest of it, since you're a Talmud Chacham, you're not learned, because the guy was good in learning. Unfortunately, you and I know, good in learning doesn't necessarily translate into good in other areas of life. And since you're good in learning, learn hard stuff. And if it's hard for you to figure out, let that pain of trying to exercise your mind and work through something difficult, let that be the pain that you suffer. Which is a very sublime, Note of Yehuda kind of art, you know. And he said, if you really want to, you know, put your mind through heavy stuff and experience the pain of trying to master dense and difficult texts, all the rest of it, do the Tosfos Yontif. You look inside there. There's an Orach Chaim 35 for those that are out there. Rabbi so-and-so told me I should give the source. It's Orach Chaim 35. It's very famous. And what do you call it? They said, learn the Tosfos Yontif. So I'm just simply suggesting to those of you out there, since it's the yard sale of Tosfos Yontif this week, if you want to do something interesting, and I'm serious about this, here comes Elul. Now, Rosh Hashanah is around the corner. Rosh Hashanah is not that long. But if you want to, just pick, I don't know, it all depends on your time. Pick the last parak of Rosh Hashanah, which talks about, mostly about the actual Rosh Hashanah rules, about the shofar and this and that and the other. And go through the Bar Tanura, not the Kahati, go through the Bar Tanura and do the Tosfos Yontif on there. And you'll see it's kind of interesting. This commentary was so popular, although sometimes too dense, that it had it received the compliment that it was condensed. So in a lot of Mishnayos that you see nowadays, you'll see on the one side, the Rav, the Bar Tanura, and the other side, what they call Iker Tosfos Yontif, which means a kitzer of the Tosfos Yontif, a a brief amount of Tosianto, and they even have those on the apps, my friend. I have an app on my phone. Believe it or not, me, you know, Mr. Technical, know nothing. And if I want to, I can see the Mishnah with the Iker Tosianto on there. That's how basic it became to the study of the Mishnahis. Now, if that's all he did, that would be a very interesting by itself. And here's somebody that by the time he was, 40, he had composed, I think he'd finished the whole doggone Tosis Yantam, all Shisha Sidri Mishnah. By the way, you have to know a lot. Kachim Tyrus, around, my goodness, you know, you have to know a lot. But he could do it. He had Torah Gadol and Malkum Echad, everything was going great. As a result, his fame spread. They asked him in his 40s to occupy some important rabbinical positions. He took position A, position B, and then position C. In position C, it blew up in his face. In position A, his first important... Until then, he was in Prague as a dayan. Well-to-do guy. Position A, they took him to Rabbi Nicholsburg, where I was with my group back in July, Mikolov, which is the capital of Jewish Moravia. And he was there for a couple years, not too long. And already you see signs of trouble because he was an honest guy. He was a champion of the poor. Champion of poor means you want the taxes to be done fairly. According to him, taxes done fairly means a graduated tax. The rich pay more, the poor pay less. Well, the rich don't want to hear that, and they're the ones that have the power in the community. So he didn't stay too long over there. But on the other hand, he was a great speaker and obviously a gigantic Talmud Chacham. And, you know, he had a charisma. And so they take him to be the rabbi after a while in Nicholsburg to Vienna, which is the capital of the Austrian, the Holy Roman Empire. We are now talking the years between 1618 and 1648, which in European history called the 30 Years' War. And that was a gigantic war that was mostly fought in Europe, I mean in Germany and German states, between the Catholics versus the Protestants. It's too long and complicated to explain, but the whole business started in Prague, okay? Prague used to be a Protestant city primarily, and then certain things happened, and it set off the 30 Years' War, and the Habsburgs, the Austrians, conquered Prague and Vienna and killed the Protestants and established a Catholic dictatorship, and they kept that down to the 20th century, which is why the Czechs in Prague till this day don't like religion. Now, how does this affect what we're talking about over here? He was a rav in these communities during a war zone. And I can tell you right now that the fighting during these 30 years was so barbaric. The whole communities got wiped out. Women were chopped in half, babies burned alive. It was like a precursor for the Holocaust. And it was a Holocaust for the Germans, but not for the Jews. It's almost funny. The Catholics and Protestants so busy fighting each other that most of the time they left the Jews alone. It's weird. You can have a Jewish, a ghetto, something like that, in a town. The ghetto turned out to be the only safe place because the Catholics attacked and wiped out the Protestants in the town and vice versa. And neither one went to the Jews. Matter of fact, they put their money in the Jewish quarter. That was like a base, you know. So it's funny, broadly speaking, the 30 Years' War, which is so terrible in its brutality, didn't hit the Jews. And he was a rabbi in the Catholic part, in the Austrian part, in Vienna, for example. And he was a rabbi there in the community. It wasn't a large community, but, you know, had money. And again, he was a good speaker and a good this and a good that. And then they asked him to come back and be a rabbi in Prague. Well. For him, this is the summa, you know, the peak. His rabbi was the Maral, who was a rabbi in Prague, and the other one with the Kliyakar, and he'd been on the base then. This was like, you know, the sum of all ambitions. Well, guess what? He came to Prague right during the 30 Years' War. I told you before, I'm simplifying, that there were all this fighting in Prague between the Catholics and the Protestants. And by the time it's over, the Catholics won, the Habsburgs, and they imposed a big fine on the Jewish community just for the heck of it. And the taxes basically doubled. Think about that. Suppose I told you tomorrow, I'm giving you real life over here. I don't know what you're paying for tuition for your day schools, but you're paying something, or yeshiva or seminary. Suppose I told you overnight it doubled. So chavis, you're paying $10,000, the price went to $20,000. People will howl if it goes up from 10 to 11 or 13 to 14. What if it went from 13 to 26 overnight? So it was a tough situation. He wanted to make it that the rich don't totally stick it to the poor. This made him a lot of enemies. among the rich. And Prague, as a community, in the early modern era, in the 15th, 16th, 1700s, was famous for two things. Number one, it was the number one center of intellectuality, the number one Malcolm Torah, the highest learning, probably. I think that's a pretty fair statement. And number two, the unbelievable Machlokes. It was like Korach City. Prague is notorious in history for having terrible, terrible fights between factions. And not over principle, over geld, over positions, and who gets to control the Gehilla, and the Chavagadisha, and all that junk. And he got right in the middle of it. And therefore, a whole faction formed against him. Same thing happened to Maral. Now it's not time to go into that, but he also got stuck over and screwed over by all these factions many times. And when he got to be the rabbi over there and then started interfering in the taxes, the other side that didn't like him, they went to the Catholic Church. They went to the Austrian government and they said he's anti-Christian. Can you believe it or not? They're Malshinim of the first magnitude. They said, look at his writings. You'll see he disses Christianity. Well, you tell it to the Catholic priest, they don't even care about the facts. The charge is enough. Next thing you know, he got arrested. And he tells the whole story in something called Megillas Eva. I see I'm already speaking 35 minutes. I don't have time to go into this book. Maybe another year. It's a like a movie. Because he got arrested and he was charged with dissing Jesus and dissing Christianity and so on and so forth in his halachic writings. And by the way, if you want to get down to it, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this because the hour is late. But, you know, he lived in a time when the Jews had to deal with the issue, with a controversial issue about Stam Yenom, about drinking geisha wine. And Stam Yenom, and a lot of Jews just bought wine at the bar, at the liquor store. You know, what you and I would call treif wine. It's not treif, but you know what I mean? It was touched by goyim. Well, strictly speaking, it should only be for pagans. Are you telling me the Christians are pagans? The Jewish tradition is very, very conflicted over this. There are books, but it's Jacob Katz's Exclusiveness and Tolerance and many other books. And the Jews kind of had, the Ashkenazic Jews developed a profile of a sort of a studied cognitive dissonance. Christianity is not Avodah Zorah, otherwise we can't do business with them, but it is Avodah Zorah, Lagabi, the wine, and things like that. You know, it's like inconsistent kind of approach. So there is, and he wrote a commentary on the Rush besides this. I'm not going to have time today to go into that. It's a shame. It's a very interesting story what happened to him, because he looked at the Rush as like the successor of the Riff, and that's a certain way of learning Gemara. But I spend all my time today talking about the Mishnah, so I'm not going to spend time on this other subject. Maybe in the future. It's very, very interesting. And the bottom line is, he did Chulin, he did Bechoras. You know, you deal with these questions of how do you define Goyim, how do you define Ovdei Avodah Zarah? Would you say a cross is an Avodah Zarah? And there's enough in those halachic writings to get somebody arraigned and accused. What kind of a shmo would do that? You understand? What kind of a guy will go to the Catholic Church, to the Austrian government, and say this guy dissed Christianity in something he wrote in Yoredeia, which nobody will even read Yoredeia if this guy did. These are Malshinim of Category A, right? A Category A storm. It's unbelievable. It happened to him. So his own guys, who didn't like him, Mamish, you know, threw him to the wall to try to get him killed. And he was carried off in chains to Vienna to be hauled in front of the court. And the church gave him a trial, and he had to, like, defend himself. And he writes the whole thing up. If this was a regular podcast, I would have skipped the first half and told you all the movie parts about his tribulations and trials in the court, in which by the time it's over, because of a quirky set, first of all, some guy, the other guys in this community went to bat for him. And when I say they went to bat for him, I mean they bribed everybody right and left. Second of all, it was kind of clear even to the people trying him that he wasn't as bad as he was described. You understand? Thirdly, and this is kind of cute, there's like a Pirkei story over here. His son, the Tosi Yontif's son, had been going to... I'll just tell you the story very briefly, and then I'm going to end this because the hour's late. Tosi Yontif's son had been sent off to yeshiva in France, in Metz. Remember I talked about Shagas? I was in Metz. Said it's in the 1600s. And he spent time there in the yeshiva there. Once upon a time was a Malkum Torah. And then he was returning home to Prague. And it's almost like a movie. And when he was on the way back, this son, he was walking or something like this, and there was a carriage that was overturned, And these two fancy ladies, a mother and a daughter, are being chased, I think, by a wild boar, if I remember correctly. They're going to get killed. And the reason was because one of the women was carrying like a red scarf. And she was too dumb to realize that's like a red flag in front of a bull, as they say. And this yeshiva student had the presence of mind to run over to the girl or the lady, whichever one, yank off the red scarf, throw it in another direction, and the boar chased off after the scarf. So the bottom line, he saved their life. And then the husband showed up. The husband was the French ambassador to the Austrian court in Vienna. And so by the time the whole story's over, this ambassador helps the son of the Tosion get his father out of jail, but at a cost of all his money. So I wouldn't say he's a millionaire, but he was quite well-to-do, and he lost everything, plus others, and he was forbidden to be a rabbi, and that wrecked his life. So that happened at the age of 50. Imagine that. At 50 or 51, he had to rebuild his life, and he did. He moved to Poland, and Poland things were better in his time, but he got into trouble in Poland also because he was a little bit too honest. Like I said, when he came into a community, they used to say like this, Rabbi, talk about the Parsha, talk about Judaism. Don't talk about how the taxes are apportioned, or as we would say today, don't talk about how the tuition is spent or how the school or the yeshiva is spending the money or where the bank accounts are. That's not your business. And he would say, no, actually, it is our business. The Torah says you have to be honest. Well, goodbye, Rabbi. You know, that's how it went. So he was like 4 or 5 towns in Poland till he ended up in Krakow. And he was a Rav here and Rav here and Rav there and Rav there. The hour is so late. I just can't forbear. He lived through the Khmelnytsky massacres, 1648, 1649. So he was actually in his 70. He was 70 when the Cossack massacres took place in Poland. Now, he wasn't there. He was in the western part of Poland. He wasn't a part of it. But he saw the Churban, you know, tens of thousands, if not more, of Jews were slaughtered by the Cossacks. And he and the rabbis got together in Poland, and they did what you wouldn't do today, which is, why did this happen to us? How do we interpret this? And they all came up under the rabbis all got together in Poland, and under the presidency of the Tosis Yontif, they said like this, we identify two sins that could account for the Holocaust that we just endured. What would be these two big sins? A, talking in shul. B, corrupt rabbis. Right? So, you know, the first one they approved of. The second one didn't make them so popular. But he said, there are a lot of corrupt rabbis over here, and that caused a churban. The first half they liked. And as you know, he made a Misha Berach. Maybe you've seen in your shul, for all those who don't talk in davening. It's called the Misha Berach HaTosis Yontif, which was a reaction to the Holocaust of 1648-1649. I've gone over my time, and I'm easily going to end up at 60 minutes. So I'm going to close it down over here. Like I said before, if you're at all interested in what I said now, the easy way to deal with this is, like I say, Rosh Hashanah is coming up. Yom Kippur is coming up. Sukkot is coming up. These are all Mishnayos that are not endless. They're not small. Yuma and Sukkot are not small exactly. But if you do some parts of it, let's say a perik with the Bar Tanur and the Tosis Yontov, you get a flavor of what I'm saying. And I'm sure if he was around, he would say that's what he would prefer also. With that, I will say goodbye.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.